to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall, and we're going to be talking with Michelle Schmidt, author of the book Carried, and we'll get into that in just a minute, but I want to let everybody know that this episode of The Cultural Hall is brought to you by Deseret Book. You can hop online, and if you get interested in this book, which I'm sure that you will, you can actually save yourself some money by entering the promo code HALL15 when you go to checkout. You can find the book at DeseretBook.com. Put it in your cart, and when you go to checkout, put in HALL15, and a special thanks to the folks over at Deseret Book for sponsoring this episode. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
I want to just dive in based on the description from your book online that I found, and I just want to start here. I think we'll gather some other pieces, but let's start here. On October 19th, 2016, Michelle Schmidt's plane landed in Oregon, where she was meeting her daughter, Annie, for a camping trip. But Annie didn't show up to the airport as her mother had planned. Will you pick it up from there?
You bet. She wasn't really answering my texts. And as I went and got my luggage and kept calling her at the airport, I thought, you know, maybe she forgot that she was going to come pick me up. So I decided to just get a rental car and drive to her apartment and see what was going on.
And at this point, you're just thinking, oh, okay, maybe she's just a little flighty. Maybe she just forgot. So then what?
Yeah. So when I got to her apartment and her roommate answered the door, and I just said, where, you know, is Annie here? She was really kind of shocked. And she said, I thought that she had already gone camping with you because I haven't seen her since Sunday morning. And that was disturbing. You know, we didn't know what was going on. But I continued to try to think that there had to be a logical explanation and that eventually we'd figure it out. But as the time passed, as I sat there in the apartment with the roommate, I really began to worry. That is when worry began to set in.
So let me ask you, the roommate had thought that she had been gone since Sunday. What day is it that you come into town?
Wednesday.
Okay, so this is several days at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was not like her. I mean, the roommate said it is just not like her to not be in contact. Like, she doesn't spend the night anywhere. She doesn't do this unless she tells me where she is. And so I just assumed she was with you.
And so what then? You said worry starts to set in. At this point, for me, paranoia kind of sets in.
You know, I tried to stay calm. I was just like, okay, where could she be? So I thought, let me look at her online banking and see where she's spending money. And then, because that's always, you know, a really good way to track your children
down.
And when I saw that she hadn't had any transactions on her card since Sunday morning, then I became very worried. I thought, okay, something is wrong. And at that point, I thought, what do you do? I'm like, I guess I go to the police. And so I tried to find my way around. And as I'm trying to drive to the police station, it becomes more than worry. It becomes like shock. I actually kind of was in shock, where your mind just becomes muddled. You can't think clearly. I couldn't follow directions on my GPS. It's something that kind of just takes over your brain. It's really an awful feeling, actually.
Yeah, but you're able to find your way through it somehow to the police station, I presume.
Eventually, I end up in some industrial area, and I call John, and I'm talking to him, and I'm telling
John,
him what's
John
going
is
on.
John is your husband.
My husband, yeah, sorry, my husband, and then I have to exercise all of my power to try and find my way to the police station, and go in and talk to them and explain my daughter's missing. And I don't know how many cases of this they see, but they kind of nonchalantly are asking me questions. Well, where was she? You know, just these questions of trying to determine how serious it could possibly be. And it's nighttime, and I don't know. I felt like I was trying to convince them something is really wrong. Like, I really feel like something's wrong at this point.
I want to stop here, and I want you to tell me about Annie, your daughter.
Annie was such a free spirit. She was so full of life and energy and love, and she was very adventurous and loved to explore. Hiking was just, even as a little girl, her dad would do date nights, and the kids could do whatever they wanted. And you'd say, what do you want to do? And she'd always say, I want to go hiking. And they'd go exploring. And she was really strong, and she would do amazing hikes. So then she loved doing things like snowboarding and longboarding, and she didn't fear. Mm-hmm. She was very adventuresome.
Yeah, even to the point that she had moved to Oregon, right? You guys are from Provo. What took her out west like that?
Well, she had gotten a job. And initially she'd gone to Texas with her brothers. They'd all gone down there to do some selling, and she hated selling, but the company had some office work, and they had an opening in Oregon, which she was just ecstatic because she'd always wanted to go up and explore the hiking up in the beautiful land of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, she'd gone up to work until she was going to start school in January and she wanted to train to be a musical engineer because she was obsessed with music. And so that is why she was up there.
And so we take it back now. You're trying to convince these police officers, which to their credit, right? I mean, they do probably see this a lot.
Oh,
and they want to make sure it's like, have you had an argument with this person? Is there any reason,
right.
You know, trying to figure it out. But when did that change for them with you?
So, they said, you know, have a seat over there and we'll send someone out. And then an officer came out and he was kind of doing the same kind of line of questioning. And I've got John on the phone with me at the same time also. And
what's he like on the phone?
He's just listening. I mean, he's so frustrated because he's so far away and there's nothing he can really do from where he was besides just listen to what's going on. And as he's listening to the conversation, he realizes that he doesn't feel like the officer is really taking us as seriously as we would like. And he finally just says, ask me if you can say a prayer. And I'm like, okay, it's a little uncomfortable, but, so I did, you know, I just say, can we say a prayer? And, he's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was received kind of how you thought it might be, right? Like, okay, lady.
Yeah. Yeah. A bit uncomfortable. I mean, that's just, you know, a super comfortable thing to do with a stranger, but
and is that a typical thing for you? Are you that type of a spiritual person that would be like, yeah, come on, let's pray? Or was that out of character for you as well?
You know, we try to involve the Lord in all of the things that we do. We try to remember to pray and to have Him be our partner, and so it's something that we do often, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But to just like ask a stranger to pray with you, no, that's not something.
Yeah.
That I do on a regular basis.
I'm kind of checking in with myself and going, yeah, I don't do that either. But, you know, for some people it is, you know, it's as secondhand as, you know what, I'm going to eat right now. Let's grab hands and let's say a prayer.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true.
So
yeah.
So he engages prayer. You in prayer, and then what?
So I say the prayer. And as I begin to pray, the first time I've prayed vocally, and I start crying. And as I reach out to Heavenly Father verbally, and I just pray that the police will be helpful and that they will be helped and be able to work to the best of their ability, and a very sweet feeling comes over us. And as I end the prayer, he has softened so much, and he was so gentle and kind, and he just said, you know, we will get someone on this right away. And it was sweet. It was turned out well.
You know, he said something on this, but I mean, at this point, I feel like you're still pretty powerless because you don't know anything, right? Have you seen her?
Exactly.
Have you talked to her? No, we don't know. So what? What happens then?
So then they assign a missing persons detective.
Okay.
To begin the investigation, and so I go check into a hotel room somewhere, and they contact us later in the night, and we get on a three-way call with John, and again, more questioning, trying to determine anything, you know, to begin a search. And and then they begin to try to track down where she was last and who she could have been with. And John and I begin our own searching. John begins to call every hospital, and I begin to call every contact that I know of that he might have been with. I mean, we just begin the search.
Mm-hmm.
We just begin to try to find her.
Now, John, I imagine, pretty powerless. You said that he wasn't there. He, I presume, was out on tour, correct?
He was at home.
Okay.
He was at home, and I had gone up to have this little trip with Annie.
Okay, so just like a mother-daughter kind of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was his inclination like, I'm on the next plane, I'll be there shortly? Or was it, you know what, there might be a simple explanation to this, let's not make any sort of rash things?
No, at this point we are extremely concerned. We are very worried. And he made plans to come as soon as he could the next day with our oldest son also. The two of them were going to come up and help look for her. And no, at this point we're very distraught. Every possible scenario that we could come up with that would explain her disappearance was just horrific.
So as your mind gets set on those things, I mean, some of those are pretty bleak and pretty...
They're horrible.
Yeah, just awful explorations of what could have happened. How do you remain calm in any of that, or some semblance of calmness?
I don't think you do. I don't think there's any way to feel like your child is experiencing something horrific and to remain calm. I think we were in shock. I was shivering, shaking. I got into bed and pulled covers up over me with clothes on, and it was just a living hell that night. It was, there's no calm. There's no, at that point, it's just horrible.
I want to take a break for a second, and I want to pick this right back up in the second block of the Cultural Hall.
Hey, this is Dan the Laptop Man from PC Laptops. It's our Ultra Mega 2018 Back to School Blowout Sale. We have hundreds of thousands of dollars of ultra high quality laptops and desktops on sale for up to 50% off the original prices. We've got demos, scratch and dents, trade-ins, and funny colored computers. It's crazy. Remember, you get a lifetime service guarantee on any PC Laptops brand computer. That means if you mess up your Windows or you get a virus or spyware, it's covered forever. Got an old yucky computer? No problem. We'll take it in on trade and we'll transfer all your pictures, music, and all your stuff to your PC Laptops computer for free. When you get your computer from PC Laptops, we'll make sure you're taken care of for a lifetime. To make it impossible to resist, we're doing 12-month special financing on any PC Laptops desktop or laptop computer. Have I lost my mind? Get into any one of our locations right now or check us out at PCLaptops.com. PC Laptops, where computers start at $799. PC Laptops, we love you.
Coming back in the second block of the Cultural Hall, talking with Michelle Schmidt, mother of Annie Schmidt, author of the book Carried, and as we last left it, you had pulled yourself in under the covers, clothes on, shivering. It's the first night. Your mind is exploring every single possible place or scenario of what could happen or could have happened to your daughter. Mm-hmm. So how do you make it through that night? This is such a foreign experience for anyone who hasn't gone through something like this, but it just sounds unbearable. Yeah. Unbearable.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is. And yet you keep breathing. Mm-hmm. So life is going. But luckily, exhaustion. Luckily, exhaustion helps you to just fall asleep eventually.
And then
And
then the next day brings.
And then the next day... I went back to the apartment and spent the day with a roommate just trying to reach out on every social media avenue that we could think of. We tried to, we got on Annie's computer and hacked into her Snapchat and her Twitter and her Instagram and just began to continue to search for her and reach out in every way possible we could. All throughout that day, we were waiting for Verizon to give us a ping on her cell phone. Because she wasn't a minor, we had to wait for a certain amount of time in order to receive that. And that was extremely frustrating because we were just wishing that we could go immediately to wherever her phone was. Working with the detective on the phone on and off intermittently throughout the day, John and Spencer arriving and working with the police. There were police out looking for, all the police were looking for her car all over the city. And later that day, luckily, they did find her car at an off-ramp to up the Columbia River Gorge, where it was a popular hiking place where several trails would head off from that place where she parked her car. So that was extremely encouraging that she had gone hiking, that she had left her car there, and that she was somewhere on the mountain.
And at this point, are the press starting to pick up on this from your daughter's social media feed, and you're starting to get people? Because I remember hearing this story here in the state of Utah that you know, that she had gone missing and that people were searching? Was it that immediate or did it take a little while longer?
I think it was that day of just putting our feelers out on every avenue, this, you know, social network avenue that we could think of where the news began to spread. And it was the next day that, actually the next morning that I saw it on the news. But it was that first day of us just putting it out there.
So you find her car and you're like, okay, there's an area. We know she likes hiking. That's a hiking, you know, spot that she would go. Encouraged at that point?
Yes, very encouraged that at least we had an idea of where she may be. And also the detective said that her car, it had been broken into, but she said that was extremely common for any car that had been left anywhere along the gorge for a day or two to be broken into. Because
right.
I guess there's people that just go up and down the gorge and breaking the cars. And there was no sign of foul play. She just said we don't have any indication whatsoever of it. And usually, if there is foul play, we see this or this or this.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that was extremely encouraging to me. It helped to alleviate some of our fears of what may have happened to her.
But still, at this point, no sign of your daughter. You didn't know where she was. And now you have kind of a starting off point. So is that, all right, you go on this trail, you go on this trail, I'll take this trail, walk for a couple hours, and we'll come back? Or how did we go?
Yeah, at the end of this news of where they found her car came towards the end of this day. This is Thursday now. And then they the police and the detective, at this point, organized an official search and rescue. So that was extremely comforting, too, that there were going to be those that do this frequently.
Yeah, professionally.
Professionally. Are going to have an organized search for our daughter, and it is going to begin early the next morning. And they begin to talk with us about this is how it's going to work. This is going to be there. This is how many people. This is how it works.
And then the next day it happens. And what was that experience like?
It was really, again, the whole experience was so surreal. I personally just felt like I was walking in a fog. It was hard to believe that it was real life. You go to base camp and there's trailers set up and it's kind of like a command office in these trailers, and they have coordinates that they're sending different groups of searchers out, and they're mapping out the areas that have been searched, and there are drones and there are airplanes that have, what is it, heat sensor
exactly.
Or something. Yeah. So it's all so overwhelming. And John and Spencer went out on search teams, and I stayed in the car and just fielded calls and media, and it was surreal. It was like living a dream.
But the end of that day doesn't yield anything.
Right. And at the end of that day, I didn't feel like I'd seen as many dog teams as they had initially said. I didn't feel like the official searchers were, that there were as many as they said that there were going to be. And come to find out, there was someone else lost in the gorge. And so they'd had to divide their teams up. And we were just having hundreds of people reaching out to us and expressing a desire to help. And so far, we kind of kept everyone at bay because the official searchers had said, we don't want people up here. We don't want them also getting lost. And so we hadn't really asked for help. But at the end of that first day, we just felt like we needed more help. And so we put out pleas on social media for anyone that felt like they could to please come help us look.
And I bet that was received throughout the churches, the Mormon churches there. I'm sorry, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in that area. And then people came out.
It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. In fact, that first day, there were people from the church there that I guess had heard about it. Well, and her bishop and her stake president up there in Oregon, and the young single adults from her ward had already come to help that first day, not necessarily to search, but they were bringing food and just being a support. It was just unbelievably kind. So the next day is Saturday, and as we come into base camp early the next morning, as the sun is just arising, there are tents set up and there's a whole other search going on that is being run by the people up there from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And they are just organizing, and they're trying not to get in the way of the official search, but they are just organizing searches. And they have tents set up with food and just that came throughout the day to feed those that came. And just hundreds of people from Utah started to come in from our wards and our community, and the support was absolutely overwhelming.
But still, as far as the search goes, even at the end of that day, nothing.
No, and it was really hard work. Like, people would come all energetic and excited and so willing and happy to help, and literally they would limp off the mountain at the end of the day as the sun was setting. It was just really hard work searching these mountains.
Discouraging at that point, at the end of that day?
Very disheartening. Yeah.
So I imagine then that the search then continues for a couple of days, and then at some point they say, yeah, I don't know, we're not going to be able to do this anymore.
Yeah, they give it 3 days. So we had Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and another search again on Sunday. And then, at the end of Sunday, they were not able to find her. They had done their best, I guess, or as far as their protocol of how they run their searches. And yeah, at that point, everyone is just, it's not just that you're physically exhausted, you're so emotionally drained, just spent. And we didn't even know how to go on. We didn't even know what to do.
Well, because at that point, you still don't have an answer, right? I mean, you've searched,
right,
and you're certainly physically exhausted. You've seen the support from those here in Utah, from those there in Oregon, from the church, etc. But still, you're in the same place where, you know, this love of your life is not to be found yet.
Yes, and also to find out that there are several people that over the past years and even that summer that still had never been found.
So then kind of fill in some gaps for me, but then go from that point, they call off the search to where she was found. What was that time period like for you?
So this is Sunday night, and we are so drained. Like I mentioned in the book, it's like we couldn't even feel like we could put together a sentence, let alone put together a game plan. Empty. And my son, Spencer, my oldest, he steps up and he just says, we've got to keep searching and we've got to have someone lead the search. And he looked to one of our good friends that was there helping search. His name's John Harding. And he looked to him as a leader. He'd been a member of the state presidency in our Bountiful Ward, and he in our Bountiful Stake. And he looked to him and just said, John, will you lead a continued search? And John, for whatever reason, felt like he should. He just felt like he was willing to take that on. And he literally took the burden and the weight of, I will carry this search for you. I will take it over. He took it from us, and it was just amazing.
So then it's not for a couple weeks until she's found. Is it John that finds her?
No. So then he continues on with the search in the ensuing days with John and Spencer. And I go home to my youngest daughter, who is just so upset at home. I leave. And there are those that stay on. But as the days go on, day after day of searching, and they're still not finding her, my John begins to feel so worried about the people that are giving all of their time looking for our daughter and not being with their families and not being at work. And he felt like if I stay, they will stay. Eventually, we need to go home and recuperate, mostly, also. So, I can't remember how long he was up there, but eventually, sometime in that next week, everybody comes home and they're exhausted and disheartened, and it's just heavy hearts, just drained and sad and empty.
Is there a feeling of like guilt, I guess, like that you left? Were there those feelings, or was it like, man, no, we literally did all we can do and we just don't know?
No, there's a feeling of great frustration, because we have sought so hard to exercise our faith and rely upon the Lord to help us. And we know he's hearing our prayers. We know he hears prayers. He has in the past. We know he could lead us right to her, and yet he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And So there was a sense of how do we handle this and not become angry and frustrated and, you know, become bitter? Like, why is he not showing us where she is? Because we know he can. Mm-hmm. We have complete faith that he can. And then there's not a sense of shame necessarily. It's more just a sense of unrest. Like, we can never rest.
Yeah.
We can never be at peace. There is no peace in sight until we find her. So you come home to have a respite, but there's no end. That is not the end of it.
Yeah.
You don't rest at night and sleep peacefully because you have to find your daughter.
So what do you do?
So then we, there were so many people reaching out to us saying, this organization helps find people. This is what you can do here. And John and I just spent hours on websites with people and on internet and on the phone talking to people. And John turned around and went back up. John Harding went back up there to search again. And there were people that went back up again. And there were people up there that never stopped looking. Mm-hmm. Like, the search never really stopped. There were people searching every day. And there was a website of those that were actually looking in areas. And they would report on what GPS coordinates that they covered that day. And there were psychics reaching out to us and saying, check this exact spot. This is where she is. And it was just a whirlwind of information of trying to sort through what would be the best thing to do. And honestly, finally, at one point, we just had to go to the Lord and say, okay, we don't know what to do. We don't know which avenue to pursue. And I took like one day in particular, and I said, I'm going to look at every single thing. I'm going to investigate it. I'm going to pray about it. And I need to get a feeling of what to go forward with and what to eliminate. And I felt so blessed that day as I went through things, because I did. I just was able to discern, no, waste of time. Don't go that way. No, I don't really trust this person. And okay, here is someone that feels really credible and like they know what they're talking about. And the person that I discovered that day was, her name was Annie Castiel, and she had done dog searches in the past. She had been a part of search and rescue teams. And as I spoke with her, I could tell that she knew what she was doing. And interestingly enough, she had had some spiritual experiences about the search for Annie and about getting involved in ways that were just miraculous. She'd had a dream where she felt like she was Annie laying on the ground looking up, and she could see where she was. And she almost felt called, as did John Harding, to be a part of the search. And I put Annie Castiel in contact with John Harding, and I said, I think this is the avenue we should go. I think we need to get more dog teams, and I think we need to go back up there and search with dogs, because I don't think people are going to be able to find her at this point mm-hmm. in a way that a dog could.
And so you did.
And so we did. And Annie had a very hard time putting together the dog teams, because there is a whole dog team search and rescue world that I had no knowledge of before. But evidently, people have a lot of ego concerning their area, and the searchers that had searched up there, I guess, had said they discouraged any other dog teams from coming up. They said, we've searched, we've looked, there's no point in coming. Mm-hmm. So as Annie would search for teams, she just was turned down repeatedly. And John Harding just had this indomitable faith. He was just so encouraging. In fact, he was amazing. As he was up there searching day after day, he would call us at the end of a night, and he would talk with us through what he had done. And then at the end, he would say, okay, so when I find Annie tomorrow, what do you want me to do with her body? And he meant it. He meant it. He was so determined that he was going to find her the next day, each day. And he kept encouraging Annie Castiel to keep looking. He kept saying, don't give up. Don't give up. You're going to find someone that will help us eventually. And eventually she did. Eventually she found people that were willing to go up there. And we had some really sweet couple of men in our stake up in Bountiful that had raised some money in order to pay for those dog teams to go back up there and search that week in November when they went up.
So fast forward to now then finding Annie and how you heard about it and then the feelings around that.
So the teams were going to go up on September 10th. November 10th. And they were going to stay just a couple of days. And that first day on November 10th, they all divvied up into different areas. Annie Castiel and John Harding kind of ran the dog search as far as organizing where people should go. And there was a woman named Lydia McGranahan that had also been miraculously brought into the search just from spiritual impressions and dreams, again, that she had felt just called to be a part of this. And she had had a very specific dream that she, again, seeing Annie hiking through Annie's eyes, and she felt like Annie was on Munra and that she had fallen. In fact, the dream that she had, she was Annie, and as she was falling, she felt that Annie left her body before she hit the ground. That was what she felt from her dream. But she was convinced that Annie was on Munra, and so...
Munra is a particular hike.
It's a particular, yeah, a particular hike.
Okay.
And she made sure that she went with the dog teams that were searching the Munra trails. And she went up with one dog team, and as they got to the base of one of the cliffs, one of the dogs marked a scent, and he began like howling or however they mark it. And there's actually a picture of that in the book, which is just so fascinating to me. As he just sits and he puts his head back and he like howls and he's like, "I've got a scent."
Mm.
And then as he began to try to follow the scent, the wind picked up and he couldn't follow it. And so later that dog, Lydia went back down with that dog, but she was determined. She was so sure that Annie was on Munra that she went up again later that afternoon with another dog. Took them right back to the same spot that the first dog marked. And the second dog marked a scent also, which is actually a huge find.
Yeah.
And, but again, could not follow the scent because of the wind. And then as they met that evening back at the base camp, no one else had marked anything. None of the dogs had found any scents. And the fact that two dogs had marked in the same spot was really a big find. But they felt that the area in which the dogs had marked were at the base of a very high cliff, up to, 100 feet cliff. And they felt that it was probably a search that would need to involve helicopters and people with climbing gear. And so they were thinking possibly they would call the search off early the next day, earlier than previously planned, because they didn't feel that they, with their dogs, were maybe going to be able to get into the places where Annie might be.
Mm-hmm.
But Lydia got there early the next morning, and also a young woman with her young German Shepherd dog. Her name was Liz Hall, and her dog was named Rue, and they got there early too. And they just said, let's go back to that same spot. So Lydia took Liz and her dog Rue up early Friday morning on November 11th up to the same spot, and Rue immediately picked up a scent and just took off. And they ran as quickly as they could behind this dog, and the terrain is just unbelievable. It is scree, and it is moss-covered boulders, and it is ferns that are 3 feet high.
Wow.
And it is incredibly hard terrain to navigate. And they're just running as fast as they can behind this dog. Liz ends up not being able to keep up, and she says to Lydia, just go, follow my dog. And they just go higher and higher and higher along the base of these cliffs, and eventually Rue stops, and he stops by some bones. And as Lydia comes upon the scene, she can tell that they're human bones, but there's nothing else. There's nothing else there except for there's clothing, there's a backpack. So Lydia sends these pictures down to John Harding, and she says, Rue has definitely found somebody. And so John Harding gets the pictures, and he calls us at home. We're in Bountiful. And John, Sarah, and I are all together, and we put John on speakerphone. And he calls us, and he says, "Okay, one of the dogs has definitely found some human remains, but we don't think there's any way it's Annie, because there's just nothing. Everything is completely decomposed except for the bones, and it's only been 3.5 weeks,
right.
And so we're thinking, okay, well, it's not Annie, but they found somebody. I'm thinking to myself, if they can find this person, then they can find Annie,
right.
If they can do this. And it's it's just something that a person never would have found. A person never would have found this, where it was. It's just under moss and under ferns, and you wouldn't have seen it. You couldn't have seen it unless these dogs can smell. So John Harding says, do you want me to send you these pictures? And we're like, yeah, for sure. Send us the pictures. And as these pictures come to us, we were like, well, that's her backpack. That's her. Those are her books. Those are her clothes. That's her shoe. That's right. John, this is Annie. So it was just overwhelming. Again, I feel like our finite minds are just not able to grasp some things fully. We dropped to our knees and we just offered prayers of thanksgiving that we had found her. She had to officially be identified through her teeth, but... And eventually they found her phone, which was on her, and her her driver's license and all of that was there also. But we were just overcome with gratitude. And then it's taken a long time. And even still today, we just are so grateful. We're still taking it in. Can you believe we found her? We're so grateful that we found her.
I want to take a break for a second, and then I want to come back and talk a little bit about that. And then ask a few other kind of aside questions, things that came to my mind as you shared that experience. We'll do that coming back in the third block of the Cultural Hall. Hey, you guys, I want to talk to you about bestdjinutah.com. Why, that's the company that I have started for doing my DJing weddings and live events. Whatever you need, I am your guy to do it. So whether you're a lifer or a convert to this podcast show, or you just happen to be listening for the first time, if you are in need of a wedding DJ or an MC for your event, or just a DJ for your business opening, go to bestdjinutah.com. Now, I know it says Utah, but guess what? If you want me to come to your event and you're not in Utah, I'll do that too. You're going to have to pay for me to be there, but I'm more than willing to do that as well. It's bestdjinutah.com. Emails there, phone numbers there. Would love to hear from you and then help you make your event that much better. Look forward to hearing from you, and thank you for supporting the Cultural Hall podcast. But it's a show. You knew that.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, again, the name of the book is Carried, and if you buy it at DeseretBook.com, when you go to checkout, the good folks over at Deseret Book who are sponsoring this episode have given us that promo code HALL15. To save 15% on this book, you can do that, DeseretBook.com. And then when you get to the cart, you add it in because you go, man, Michelle has a great story. I can't wait to read all of it, the stuff that she doesn't have time to mention in this episode. You put in the promo code HALL15 and save yourself some money and get a great book. Now, Michelle, you said there's overwhelming feelings of gratitude as you see these pictures and go, oh, that's her. That to me, I feel like I arrive at gratitude, but at first, I don't know that gratitude is where my mind and heart goes.
Well, that's where ours went. We were just so thankful to find her because we didn't know if we would.
Yeah.
There was the chance that we never would find her. So the fact that we did, we were just so thankful to be able to have peace concerning where she was, to be able to bring her remains back, to be able to bury her, and to have closure. It would be so hard to go on with life having your child just missing forever. I know that happens to people, and I don't know how you cope, but I know they have to, but oh, so hard. And my husband John had a tour scheduled to perform in the next month or so, and he was just like, I couldn't have gone out and played the piano and gone on with life knowing that I hadn't found my daughter.
You mentioned that there was never that feeling of anger. Is that real? You never felt angry at God or angry at, you know, some sort of that the prayers weren't reaching heaven or anything like that? There was never a moment of doubt?
I did not get angry at God. I didn't. It wasn't his fault. It wasn't his fault she went hiking and got lost. It wasn't. And I knew that he could answer our prayers. And if he didn't, there had to be a reason. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think I know more than he does. I just don't. And if I were to presume that I knew more, I mean, I'm an idiot. I don't know anything. I don't know how to make a world.
Right.
I don't know how to do anything compared to him. So to me, to question God to me is just ridiculous. But it doesn't mean that I wasn't super sad. And there were times when I would try to like negotiate with him and say, hey, I helped create this body. You know, do I have some claim on it? Like I would try to, I would try to reason with him. And
did you try and make a deal? Those are my favorites. And those times of weakness where I try and make a deal, like, okay, so if you don't mind helping me out just a little more than normal, I'll.
Yeah, I would try to convince him. Mm-hmm. Which is also pretty silly, but at the same time, I would try to reason with him, and then I would try to submit. I would, and this is an ongoing wrestle I had within myself because I would be like, okay, I am so determined to submit to your will, and if it is that we don't find her, I need you to help me understand how to handle it. So, and I knew that I could ask him for that help because he had helped me in the past, and to be fair, I need to explain that half of the book is not about Annie's story. It's about my life experiences where I have learned to trust God, the different things that I have experienced and gone through that have helped me to know that it doesn't do any good to get angry at him. Mm-hmm. It is pointless to try to manipulate a situation. So I talk a lot in the book about, and I quote from my journals and things, of experiences that I have had that have taught me to trust God and that enabled me to do so in this horrific experience of losing Annie.
Is it a reference, as I hear your story and what you're talking about and see the title of the book is Carried, is it sort of a very slight reference to the "it was then that I carried you"?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like the Lord literally carried us through this experience and that he's carried us through our lives time and time again, and that we were carried by others. We were carried by just amazingly kind people that helped us, that sustained us. There were hundreds, if not thousands of people that were praying for us, that were exercising their faith for us, that fasted for us. And those prayers carried us. We felt sustained. We felt helped. We felt carry.
I love it. And I love that you are so willing to share the story. I think that there is a great amount of faith to be gained by the story that you share. And that, you know, I mean, this is really recent. You know, we're not 2 years out, but that you're willing to share not only here with me, but also in the book to be able to share the story and how how you were in fact carried. But
you know, and that's what I hope. I just hope that it can help strengthen faith, because honestly, I'm a private person. Mm-hmm. I do not post pictures of me doing anything with my family. That's not something I enjoy doing. And yet I have written a book where I have shared some of my most vulnerable personal, spiritual journeys and experiences. And it's really, I mean, it's a huge stretch for me to have done that. But at the same time, I feel a need to share my faith, mm-hmm. and to hopefully make a difference for good in hopefully strengthening someone else's faith to whatever degree I am able to.
We ask everyone who steps into the Cultural Hall 3 questions, and so I will ask those of you right now. The first question, what is your calling right now, if you have one?
I am the primary chorister, best call in the world.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that actually exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Oh, you know, I am in the mood to work with young adults. My kids are young adults. And I feel like I really get their struggles right now. And I think that's an area where I could love and serve right now.
And then the final question, and interpret this question however you will. What is your favorite part of your faith?
Trust in God.
Talk about that.
I just have I just have a witness that God is real, that he loves us, that he is aware of us, and that as we seek to stay close to him, that we can give our life to him, and that he will guide us, that he will guide us through to the most fertile part that this life has to offer, that he will help us navigate through the most difficult circumstances and experiences. And I feel like that trust in God, and when I say God, I also mean our reliance upon our Savior, Jesus Christ, and the power of his atonement. And I feel like an ability to stay connected to them is so closely linked to the Book of Mormon. It brings us to them every day as we read from those pages.
I appreciate you taking some time and being here in the Cultural Hall with us. For those that are listening, if you love stuff like this, remember that you can be a part of our Patreon group. It's The Cultural Hall, patreon.com/The Cultural Hall. If you like to donate to this episode and to The Cultural Hall, continuing to share stories like the one we heard from Michelle Schmidt. The book is called Carried. Again, you can buy it at DeseretBook.com and use the code HALL15. That also helps Deseret Book know, hey, you know what? There's lots of people that love The Cultural Hall and loved hearing Michelle's story. Michelle, I hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you're not healthy enough to listen to it this week, you'll be healthy enough to listen to it next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of The Cultural Hall.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be